Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop will be recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Charlotte, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, update on soft tissue sarcoma. And I know many of you have waited to hear this program for a while, and it's an important program for us to offer all of you. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And we also, in addition to the general cancer organizations, we also are collaborating with the Sarcoma Alliance and Sarcoma Foundation of America, so that we are actually, there are other sarcoma organizations that are working with us to help spread the word about the program. And because of that collaboration and because of your interest in the program, we have on today's program over 568 participants, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom, so a bit of a global call. We're delighted to have all of you on the call today, and you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. We have wonderful speakers on our program today, and we're going to first have our speakers' presentations, and then after our speakers conclude their presentations, we will have plenty of time, actually, for questions. So, and if we don't get to all of your questions, I will give you resources at the end in terms of how to get your questions answered. But our first speaker, just to start off now, is Dr. Suzanne George. And Dr. George is Clinical Director, Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, Senior Physician, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. George is going to present an overview of soft tissue sarcoma. She will discuss current standard of care and new treatment approaches, side effect management, and key questions to ask your healthcare team. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. George.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for the invitation to talk today about soft tissue sarcoma. As Dr. Messner said, I'm a medical oncologist at Dana-Farber, and I hope to be able to provide you with some general background on sarcomas as well as current standard of care, some treatment changes that have occurred over the last couple of years, and then touch on side effect management and key questions. So as many of you may know, soft tissue sarcoma is really a group of diseases. It's a single disease. We often talk about soft tissue sarcoma, but it really encompasses many different diseases. And if one were to look at the most common subtypes of soft tissue sarcoma, that would be leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma, but there are many additional types. Depending on the classification system that one reviews, there could be 50 or more different subtypes. Angiosarcoma, synovial sarcoma, epithelioid sarcoma, microfibrosarcoma, and differentiated, so they go on and on. And I think it's important to recognize this heterogeneity because sarcoma is a disease that we're increasingly understanding unique biologic aspects of these different sarcomas. And this is helping us to think about strategies moving forward from a treatment perspective. It's also important to note that soft tissue sarcomas can occur in almost any part of the body. So although most commonly soft tissue sarcoma occurs in the lower extremity, we know that soft tissue sarcomas can also originate in an upper extremity, in the trunk, and also in the head and neck, in the abdominal cavity, or even primarily arising from an organ, such as the uterus, occasionally primary in the lung. And this is important because, again, when it comes to treatment planning, this can have impacts on surgical approaches and radiation approaches, as our subsequent speakers may allude to. So in summary, soft tissue sarcoma is a disease that we're continuing to learn more and more about. It's a heterogeneous group of subtypes, and they can occur in almost any part of the body as a primary site. Important to note that primary management of these tumors, when they're localized, meaning in just one place, tends to still be very much reliant on local therapy, meaning surgery and radiation. And again, Dr. Delaney and Dr. Molliner will talk about this further later on in the program. We do know, however, though, that a portion of people with soft tissue sarcoma will ultimately develop disease recurrence despite aggressive and appropriate local care. The most common sites for the tumor to come back, if it is distant to occur, is in the lung. Some histologies, however, have a higher propensity of recurrence in the abdomen. That's specifically true for patients with retroperitoneal sarcomas, meaning sarcomas that start in the back of the abdominal cavity, and that are a liposarcoma. Those, rather than spreading to the lung, are actually more likely to spread into the abdomen, right in the same places where they started. And this is why, again, the understanding the heterogeneity, meaning what subtype of sarcoma and where did the tumor start, can have significant impacts on care, because understanding the baseline disease helps us to tailor the follow-up program for each individual. An extremity sarcoma may be more likely to spread to the lung, if it is to spread at all, and in that case, we do close screening of the lungs in follow-up. A retroperitoneal, well-differentiated liposarcoma, for example, might have an almost negligible risk of lung spread or lung metastases. And in that case, our follow-up is much more focused on abdominal imaging. Again, highlighting the heterogeneity of the disease. So with regard to standard of care, as I mentioned earlier, localized disease is typically focused on local measures, meaning surgery and radiation. At times, we include chemotherapy as part of that upfront treatment, again, depending on the histologic subtype, with ring sarcoma, osteosarcoma, and rhabdomyosarcoma as certainly being required to have chemotherapy even at the earliest stages of disease. And some other histologies, such as angiosarcoma and mixed liposarcoma, depending on the location of the tumor, the size of the tumor, and the risks of surgery and radiation, chemotherapy may be interesting. There are a number of new therapies that have been recently approved by the FDA for treatment of soft tissue sarcoma that has spread or recurred. And these last few years have been really quite dramatic in that regard, in that there have been four new drugs approved in this uncommon tumor type because of the field we're getting more strategic in our study design and are in a position that we can identify active therapies in really more targeted disease populations, even within the overall soft tissue sarcoma umbrella. And then briefly we mentioned, so pazopanib is a drug that was approved as a multi-targeted kinase inhibitor, improved really in a non-histology specific, meaning for soft tissue sarcoma in general. The drug was approved based on showing that people who had taken pazopanib had disease which grew at a slower rate than people that did not. Important to note that the drug was studied in people that had had what I would call later line therapy, meaning had already tried several other kinds of chemotherapies, and then were given pazopanib, and a subset of people clearly had a benefit. Other drugs that have been approved recently include trastuzumab, which is also known as Yondelis, or it's a very early name. It's a drug called ET743. It's all the same compound. It's a drug that's extracted from a sea squirt and was found to have some interference with DNA cell and cell division. This drug had been used in clinical trials for a number of years in the U.S. and was approved in Europe a number of years ago. But more recently, we had a very targeted type of study here in the United States where the tumor types that seemed to have the best response to Yondelis were the tumor types that were actually studied in the what we call pivotal trial. So this was a study which included only leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma. These were the tumor types that we knew the drug had the most activity in and ultimately were approved based on the activity. So trabectedin is an important drug to be aware of for treatment of leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma that has recurred, again, in sort of the later line therapies, meaning after already standard treatment. Eribulin is another drug recently approved for liposarcoma, again, done in a study with liposarcoma and leiomyosarcoma because earlier studies had suggested that these two particular histologies were uniquely sensitive to this drug. And what we saw in the final data was actually Arivulin seemed to be most effective against liposarcoma, but we also, and then that's where the FDA approval came in, but we also believe that there's activity in leiomyosarcoma, and consensus groups such as the NCCN have endorsed Arivulin and leiomyosarcoma as well. Another more broad approval that has occurred even more recently is a drug called olaratumab. Olaratumab is an antibody against a target called PDGF receptor alpha. And when used with doxorubicin in tumor types where one would have used doxorubicin anyways, meaning the study was designed for people who the doctors felt that doxorubicin would be a good option because that's the standard option that we've used in sarcoma for many years and remains a very important frontline therapy. So the study looked at doxorubicin compared to people who received doxorubicin olaratumab, and people who received the combination therapy seemed to have a benefit over the long term compared to patients who received doxorubicin alone. There is some increased toxicity when using the combination, meaning more side effects, particularly with regard to fatigue and lowering of the blood count. Because the response, the benefit in the combination arm was quite significant compared to the single agent, the drug, as I mentioned earlier, was indeed approved on a relatively small patient experience. With that said, the FDA required that a larger, what we call confirmatory study, be performed to ensure that when the drug was being used in a broader population, that that benefit indeed was reproducible. And that study has already completed its accrual, meaning patients have already been enrolled. It is now closed, and we're waiting for the outcome. And I think that what this really shows us is that as clinical trialists and as sarcoma investigators, we have been working hard to try to be more strategic about the drugs that we use in the specific subtypes of soft tissue sarcoma, and I think that's been helpful to further advancing the field that we have now. I think future options include exploring immunotherapy, which is a way to try to get the immune system to identify the tumor, and there's a lot of work ongoing in that area, as well as other targeted therapies and additional types of chemotherapy. Briefly, I just want to mention side effect management in a general sense to say that side effects vary quite a bit depending on what modality we're talking about, the surgical side effects, the radiation side effects, or the chemotherapy-associated side effects. We certainly encourage patients to stay in close contact with their doctors to be sure that they're communicating about what they're feeling. And recently at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, just this past weekend, there was data presented to suggest that using tools to stay in good connection with your care team has helped patients do better. Because certainly as providers, we want to be able to support whatever symptoms someone's experiencing. And I can say from a chemotherapy perspective that we are the best tools that we've ever had to help support the side effects of chemotherapy. I think there's still opportunity for improvement for sure, that we continue to improve our tools in that area. And lastly, I just want to touch base on key questions to ask. Most important, because your care needs to be a collaboration between you as the patient, the person, and the family that's going through this illness, but together with your care team. People are living with these diseases longer and longer, and we want to be sure to have the right relationship, and asking questions is a key part of that. Important to know is to understand what type of sarcoma you have. Has a specialty sarcoma pathologist reviewed the pathology? Is that important in my case? Where is the disease? Is it in one place or is it in more than one place? And then if we're talking about, and I would also strongly encourage to ask if there are clinical trials that are available and appropriate for each stage of the disease and journey that one goes through. So I know I've probably gone over my time a little bit, so I'm going to stop now, and I'll turn it over to the other speakers.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. George. That was really outstanding and really very comprehensive in covering a lot of the issues that so many people living with sarcoma have questions about. So thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Thomas Delaney, and Dr. Delaney is the Andres Soriano Professor of Radiation Oncology, Harvard Medical School. He's radiation oncologist, Department of Radiation Oncology, Medical Director, Francis H. Burr Proton Therapy Center, and co-director, Center for Sarcoma and Connective Tissue Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Delaney is going to address the role of radiation oncology, types of radiation treatments, clinical trials, and how research contributes to treatment options and follow-up care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Delaney.
Thank you, Carolyn. So I'll be discussing the role of radiation therapy in the management of soft tissue sarcomas. Radiation therapy refers to the use of high-energy X-rays or other particles to kill cancer cells. A physician who specializes in giving radiation therapy to treat cancer is called a radiation oncologist. Radiation therapy is often used in conjunction with surgery for the treatment of sarcoma at the site where the tumor arises, because there's frequently microscopic extension beyond the tumor that the surgeon can see. If one were to try to do more radical surgery to remove more tissue to eradicate this microscopic disease beyond the visible tumor, one risks the loss of some of the function in the limb for tumors arising in the extremities. In addition, surgery to obtain adequate margins around the tumor may not be possible in some anatomic locations. As Dr. George mentions, these tumors can arise nearly anywhere in the body. So when sarcomas arise in the head and neck region, or in the back of the abdomen, what we refer to as the retroperitoneum, it's very difficult to get an adequate surgical margin around the tumors. I would emphasize again what Dr. George mentioned, that since sarcoma is rare, it's extremely important to talk with a radiation oncologist who has experience treating multiple patients with sarcomas on a regular basis. Because the radiation doses that we need to eradicate microscopic tumor cells are lower than those to remove a lump of tumor, the combination of removal of the tumor that you can see by the surgeon in conjunction with a radiation dose allows you to use a lower radiation dose, and it results in very high rates of local tumor control at the site of the original tumor in most locations where sarcomas arise, in particular in the arms and legs, which is the most common site for these tumors. Our local tumor control is over 90%. That being said, there are also some sarcomas, generally those in the thigh, often smaller tumors, and tumors that are what we refer to as low-grade tumors, tumors that have a low risk of spreading elsewhere in the body. A number of these small sarcomas can be adequately treated with surgery alone with a wide margin, and such patients would not need irradiation. And Dr. Mullinax will discuss surgery further when I've finished talking about radiation. In addition, there are some patients with sarcoma. Generally, these are ones that occur in the head and neck region or the spine, where cancer surgery is not only difficult, but may result in very significant either cosmetic or functional side effects. And in those patients, radiation can be considered an alternative to surgery, although this requires higher doses of radiation and often very sophisticated radiation techniques. The most common type of radiation treatment is called external beam radiation therapy. And this refers to radiation that is delivered from a machine that's outside of the person's body. When radiation treatment is given using radiation sources placed into the tumor or in close proximity to the tumor, we call that brachytherapy, and that's a kind of treatment that is used for a number of sarcomas, particularly those that arise in the arms or the legs. The kind of treatment that we give with radiation is usually on a schedule that consists of a specific number of treatments over a set period of time, generally 5 days a week for 5 to 7 weeks. And the radiation is often for treatment of sarcomas done before surgery, and this allows the radiation to sterilize the tumor cells at the edge of the visible tumor. This allows us to use smaller radiation fields than when you're treating after surgery, and it also allows somewhat lower radiation doses, so this can be a preferred option for some patients. radiation is often, or at least in some patients who have large sarcomas, can also be given in conjunction with chemotherapy. And this is particularly where you're looking to try to shrink the tumor to facilitate the surgical removal of the tumor. And in some other patients, it may be done to reduce the risk of spread of a large sarcoma to other parts of the body. Radiation can often allow the surgeons to do a lesser surgical procedure, and this can allow the surgeon to do a less radical surgery, and results in better limb function when combined with radiation can often result in a high chance of curing the tumor at the site where it arises. Radiation therapy, however, can have some effect on the normal cells that are adjacent to the tumor. Fortunately, with modern techniques, the side effects are limited generally to the areas around the tumor, and increasingly we're able to focus the higher dose radiation at the tumor and a relatively narrow margin around it. Some of these newer radiation techniques include what's called intensity modulated radiation therapy, and another one is called proton radiation therapy. Intensity modulated radiation uses multiple small beams of radiation that are given as the machine rotates around the body. It's frequently now used for patients with sarcoma. It focuses the radiation more conformally around the tumor site and spares more of the critical normal tissue. And as a result, there are fewer side effects during treatment than there were in the past. The side effects from radiation therapy are really related to the site of the body that's being treated. Most of the side effects are confined to the area that's being treated, with the exception of some fatigue that generally accompanies most courses of radiation therapy. Patients may have some skin reaction in the area that's being treated. When we're treating the abdomen, there may be nausea associated with treatment and some change in bowel habits, particularly towards the end of treatment. In the short term, the radiation therapy can cause what looks to be redness in the skin that looks somewhat like a sunburn. It's managed with moisturizing creams during the course of treatment that tend to keep the skin soft and help to relieve discomfort associated with the treatment. Radiation treatments can also affect wound healing, and we work in close collaboration with the surgical colleagues to reduce the risk of wound healing problems related to radiation treatment. Radiation can also have effects that appear months to years after treatment. Some of these include what's called fibrosis, or thickening of the tissues in the arms of the legs, although with modern techniques, this usually does not have significant limit on the function of the arm or the leg, because the majority of patients treated with modern sarcoma techniques have good or excellent functions of the arm or the leg that's treated. In some locations, such as in the groin, the combination of surgery and radiation may result in some swelling of the leg or lymphedema, and in these cases, patients after treatment may require a stocking to reduce the swelling in the leg. Rarely, radiation can cause a second cancer unrelated to the sarcoma that's being treated. Fortunately, this is an unlikely event that may occur in about 0.5% of patients treated at 15 years after treatment. Nevertheless, because it can be a very significant side effect, we always carefully consider which patients need radiation and which patients, as I mentioned, who might have small tumors do not need to have radiation treatment. It can be managed appropriately with surgery. I think all patients should sit down with the treating physician and discuss any possible side effects of treatments, as well as the potential risk versus benefit for the treatment that's being given. Most of the early side effects from radiation treatment subside within a couple of weeks of treatment. As I mentioned earlier, another recent radiation technique is proton beam radiation. This uses charged particles that travel a certain distance and stop, and that allows the total radiation dose to the body to be reduced about 50%. It's in general, it's used on a regular basis for young patients to reduce the risk of side effects related to treatment. Many patients with extremity or arm or leg tumors, whoever, can be treated with X-rays without the use of protons. One of the other techniques that I had mentioned for treatment of sarcomas is brachytherapy. This refers to the insertion of radioactive seeds through thin tubes called catheters directly into the area where the sarcoma is arising. It's generally done in the operating room at the time of the surgical removal of the tumor. It can allow a shorter course of radiation over the course of a week, and it localizes the radiation extremely well to the area of the tumor. This, however, as for most treatment of sarcomas, requires specialized skills and special training. It is generally used only in certain hospitals, and this technique is one where, as I mentioned, starts in the operating room at the time of the surgical removal. The catheters are left in place, and then starting 5 days after surgery, the radiation is delivered through a machine that has a radiation source that will connect into the catheters that have been placed into the tumor bed. And treatment is generally done once or twice per day for about 5 days, and then these catheters are then removed at the bedside in the hospital before the patient is removed. And the patient is discharged from the hospital. One other technique that is sometimes used is called intraoperative radiation. This can be particularly useful for intra-abdominal sarcomas, where sensitive normal tissues such as the bowel, which really are between the skin and the sarcoma, can be moved out of the way, and very localized radiation can be given to an area where the tumor may be abutting a normal structure that would be difficult to remove, such as the abdominal wall or the spine. One other technique that if you are a sarcoma patient, may have heard about is called stereotactic radiation. This refers to highly focused radiation treatments where the tumor is targeted from multiple angles with small fields, and higher than the usual dose of radiation is given for 1 to 5 treatment sessions, with the intent of ablating or killing a tumor nodule which has spread from the primary tumor. And this is generally in the setting where sarcoma has spread to the lung, liver, or bone. And this technique can be quite effective. It may be an alternative to surgical removal in a situation where surgery may be difficult. The next topic that I want to discuss briefly, and Dr. George had mentioned this as well, are cancer clinical trials and how research contributes to your treatment options. The current local treatment of sarcomas that arise in the arms and the legs results in a very high rate of disease control at the site where the primary tumor arises. Nevertheless, patients who have tumors that appear aggressive under the microscope, we call these high-grade tumors, and in particular those tumors that are larger than 2 inches in size, have a very significant risk of microscopic spread of tumor to distant sites, particularly the lungs. And this spread often occurs before any treatment is done. The conventional chemotherapy approaches have unfortunately shown only modest benefit in this setting, so we are all interested in trying to improve the outcome in patients who have microscopic or more disease that has spread to other sites of the body. And new treatment approaches are tested in cancer clinical trials, and these are generally employing drugs or other treatment strategies that have shown promise in laboratory models of sarcomas. For extremity sarcomas, some of the promising treatments that are being tested in ongoing clinical trials include testing chemotherapies, including pazopanib that Dr. George mentioned, that is aimed at targeting a number of growth regulatory enzymes in tumors. And another approach that's being tested is the use of immune therapy, molecules called checkpoint inhibitors that allow the immune system to attack the tumor, which have shown benefit for melanoma, lung cancers, and a number of other tumors, are now being combined with preoperative radiation and surgery, and we'll see if the outcome is better than the standard treatment with preoperative radiation and surgery without the checkpoint inhibitors. For sarcomas in the abdomen, or what's also known as the retroperitoneum, where it's very difficult for the surgeon to obtain a wide surgical margin around the tumor, an ongoing clinical trial is comparing the outcome of preoperative radiation and surgery to surgery alone. And another ongoing study is assessing the potential value of higher than standard radiation doses in this setting, targeting the highest risk margin in the back of the abdomen with either protons or intensity modulated radiation therapy. The last topic I'll discuss today is follow-up care after treatment of the sarcoma and what's referred to as cancer survivorship. After completion of treatment, follow-up, one important aspect of follow-up care for patients who have tumors of the arms or the legs is physical therapy and rehabilitation to optimize limb function for patients treated for sarcomas. And there's also what we refer to as surveillance care, which refers to the regular visits with the treating physicians to monitor the primary tumor site after treatment, as well as to do scans to assess whether there's been any spread of the tumor to the lungs or liver or other organs. Initially, these are scheduled about every 3 months for the first 2 to 3 years, and then 4 to 6 month intervals out to 5 years, and then generally yearly out to 10 years. And at these visits, there'll generally be a physical examination of the primary tumor, and at times MRI or CT imaging of the site of the primary tumor, and particularly those areas that can't be easily examined, such as the abdomen and the chest. Patients will have CT scans to assess both the chest and the abdomen. For some patients, if the tumor has not been removed, patients may have a PET CT scan, which uses a sugar tagged with a radioactive tracer, to look at the metabolic activity in the treated tumor. And this is a way of monitoring whether a residual lump after cancer treatment, which can sometimes be the case in tumors that are radiated to high dose and haven't been removed, that residual tumor may just be a fibrotic dead mass after treatment. And one way of assessing it is using a PET scan to see if there's any metabolic activity to suggest active and living tumor. We also use these late visits to identify and address any late side effects from cancer treatment, and in particular, if those are identified, to suggest strategies that might reduce the impact of these side effects on the patient's life. So at this point, Dr. John Mullinax will address the role of surgery in the treatment of soft tissue sarcomas.
Thank you very much, Dr. Delaney. That was outstanding, and as always, and really very comprehensive as well. And a lot of detail about the role of radiation treatment and also in terms of follow-up care and surveillance. So thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Dr. John Mullinax. And Dr. Mullinax is instructor, surgical oncology, sarcoma department, immunology department, H. Lee Moffitt Cancer Center and Research Institute. And Dr. Mullinax is going to be addressing the role of surgery in the treatment of soft tissue sarcoma, the importance of the pathology report, pain management, and quality of life concerns. It's really my pleasure now to introduce and to all of you and to turn the program over to Dr. Mullinax.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you all today, and honored to be in the presence of such great colleagues as we have with us today. So I'd like to talk first about, as we said, the role of surgery in the treatment of soft tissue sarcoma. And before we get into the specifics relative to the resections, I think it's important to talk about what should be done before you meet with the surgeon. And most patients are often referred from their medical oncologist or from their primary care physician after a biopsy. I think before meeting with the surgeon, evaluating that person's experience with treating malignancies in general, but most specifically soft tissue sarcoma is important. These are rare tumors that aren't often seen by surgeons, and I think, you know, to receive the optimal care, it's important to have someone who's has a good familiarity with treating these types of cancer, and most specifically cancer surgery in general. I think at the initial visit with the surgeon, many times patients arrive, as I said, and referred after a biopsy or a limited evaluation, and I think bringing those records with you for the first visit is incredibly important. Things that we are most interested in at that first visit are, of course, any prior biopsies or imaging that have been done, which resulted in that visit to the surgeon's office. In the office, we generally will review the films with the patient, and so bringing a copy of the images, most commonly these days on a CD, is extremely helpful. It's very difficult to have a discussion relative to a proposed resection without the exact images, and I think many times the patients I find when I see them are happy to sit down and discuss the images because they many times haven't seen them before to get a better idea of where the lesion is and what necessarily is involved. The pathology report from a prior biopsy is also very important. We all approach the soft tissue sarcomas with what we refer to as a histologic specific management plan. And so not all sarcomas are treated the same. And so understanding the subtype of sarcoma, if you've been given that diagnosis before the referral, is incredibly important. I think another thing that's important to bring, and as patients visit multiple different physicians throughout their cancer journey, they sort of develop this schedule and a timeline of events. And having a good grasp of what's happened prior to that visit with the surgeon is important. Maybe you've seen another surgeon who's recommended a particular resection, or maybe you've seen a medical oncologist or a radiation oncologist who has prescribed a certain treatment regimen. And I think having those as many details as possible along with dates is very important. Many times the patients don't often get a final treatment plan at that initial visit with the surgeon, and I think sometimes that's frustrating for patients, but I would argue that that's actually a good thing, and that means that your surgeon's thinking about more of the care of your tumor relative to the other treatment modalities that might be important. Many times we need to acquire the outside biopsy slides for a review if there's not a specific diagnosis. Many times we need further imaging to evaluate the stage of the patient. And many times we also confer with our colleagues in the medical oncology and radiation oncology department to talk about preoperative therapy that might be undertaken before we proceed with a resection. So once the decision's been made to proceed with the resection of the soft tissue sarcoma, which is clearly a very fundamental and important part of the treatment for soft tissue sarcoma, that surgical discussion is incredibly important. Things that I always focus with in patients, and I encourage you to ask surgeons that you may be visiting with and discussing, is how does this resection fit in to your overall cancer care relative to the chemotherapy and radiation, as Dr. Delaney and Dr. George have so eloquently outlined. I think it's important to ask and really understand the expected changes in your quality of life in the short and long term. When we're talking about tumors of the extremities, many times the resection can result in some form of neuropathy or weakness or loss of function. And oftentimes in the abdomen or the pelvis, this can require resection of other organs. And it's important to understand how that would affect your quality of life going forward. Also, it's important, and I always discuss with the patients, who's going to be there with you after the surgery. So clearly you'll be in the hospital for many of the operations that I perform in the retroperitoneum and the pelvis for, a week or so. And when you go home, it's important that there's someone there that can help. The understanding the family structure and the support system of the patient is incredibly important preoperatively, and evaluating that postoperatively can oftentimes lead to some issues with discharge and questions about who's going to care going forward. I think once the decision's and you've had a thorough discussion and you feel satisfied with the surgical plan, the perspective of the surgeon in the operating room is really quite simple at the outset, but carried out in a complicated fashion. So our goal is to always remove the tumor in a complete manner. And oftentimes in the retroperitoneum and the pelvis, that requires resection, as I said earlier, of adjacent viscera, whether it be the bowel, the spleen, portion of the bladder, et cetera. Most often for the retroperitoneum, that involves resection of a kidney. And I think that's a discussion that isn't maybe discussed as much preoperatively, but certainly should be. And the loss of a kidney relative to your long-term function and eligibility for future treatments, including some chemotherapy regimens afterwards, is certainly a discussion point that should be understood preoperatively. In the operating room, many patients ask, a common question I get is, well, do you check the margins? I've heard about frozen sections. We don't typically use frozen sections in the operating room, and that's because many times these soft tissue sarcomas are difficult for the pathologist to assess in a frozen section manner, and so that's not something that's typically done, which you may have heard about in other types of malignancies, but it's certainly not something that we typically do in the operating room. I think another consideration, as Dr. Delaney mentioned, would be intraoperative radiation therapy or brachytherapy. These are modalities that are certainly employed in the operating room and in collaboration with our radiation oncology colleagues. And, you know, that's certainly a decision we make preoperatively and something that, if you have a question regarding that, should be brought up in that preoperative discussion. Moving along, so after the resection, the hospital stay, you'll visit back typically with your surgeon a couple weeks after the operation, after your discharge, to evaluate your post-operative recovery. Many times patients are very anxious regarding that pathology report. So you went to the operating room and you had a very large, many times complicated resection with a long hospital stay, and the focus on that pathology report, I explained to patients that while it many times takes 10 days to 2 weeks for that report, it's important to give the pathologist time to do a thorough evaluation of that tumor that was resected, both in terms of the primary diagnosis but also the margin assessment. These can be very difficult for the pathologist due to the size of the resection many times and the complex nature of the primary tumor. Things that are important to understand from that pathology report are really the size, the grade, the margins, and the specific histologic subtype of that tumor. These are things that your surgeon will discuss with you, and then that may change your long-term treatment plan. So many times going to the operating room with one plan in terms of an adjuvant treatment, adjuvant being treatment after surgery, can change relative to that pathology report. And those discussions are important to have at that post-operative visit. I think another comment to make regarding a pathology report is oftentimes we see patients in the surgical clinic that have had what we refer to as an unplanned resection, meaning somebody went to the operating room with a soft tissue mass that they didn't know with a malignancy, and then after the resection found out an unexpected result that it was in fact a malignancy. And I think those pathology reports are important as well, and those will be, of course, present at your initial surgical discussion. Very important from those, of course, again, the margin status and that histologic subtype, understanding the grade of that tumor and whether that unplanned resection there were positive or negative margins and which specifically were. Another point to make relative to the surgical portion of the treatment of your soft tissue sarcoma is pain management. This is something that certainly brings anxiety to patients at our initial surgical discussion, and I think it should really be addressed in several different formats. The first is really the patients that have a need preoperatively for pain medications from the primary tumor itself. If that's the case, then it's important to understand that postoperatively, the pain is oftentimes more difficult to control. And I think having a discussion about the availability of a pain management team in your inpatient hospital stay is should be done in the preoperative setting. Planning is always better than reacting, and I think having that understanding of the postoperative pain control and the services available to you at the institution that you're seeking care is important. For patients that don't have any need for preoperative pain control, the postoperative acute pain is generally well controlled with a modality we call PCA, or patient-controlled analgesia. This is an IV pain medication given to patients where the medication is given by the patient to the patient by the pushing of a button. Not possible to overdose on this medication, and many patients are concerned, and I think oftentimes don't use the medication quite enough because they're concerned about the side effects, but certainly your physician who's prescribed it has taken that into account, and it's a very effective way to control pain, certainly in the first 48 to 72 hours after the operation. Epidurals are used more sparingly, I would say, but certainly can be used in these large abdominal and thoracoabdominal resections. And in epidurals, which are very similar, the same pain management technique is used in obstetrics. However, a catheter is left within the epidural space, and postoperatively, the patient also can control their pain by the use of narcotics using epidural catheter. This is not done routinely or commonly, but certainly for larger operations, it's worth a discussion before your resection about this opportunity. Moving along outside the hospital in terms of pain management, certainly going home with narcotics is important, and we encourage that, but I think there has been a push of late, and we recognize that many times patients go home with narcotics that they don't otherwise need. I think I explain to my patients, certainly take them if you need them, but it's not a medication like your blood pressure medicine that you should take regardless every day. There are certainly side effects to narcotics, mostly relative to your gastrointestinal system, specifically constipation and nausea, and I think a lot of times patients may use narcotics when other effective pain medications can be used. Finally, I want to touch on some quality of life concerns. And I think these are important in terms of looking at the care of the soft tissue sarcoma patient from a global sense. As I mentioned before, one of the things I talk about in the preoperative discussion is who's there to help. When you go home, oftentimes patients are quite apprehensive. They may have drains. They may have decreased function relative to the resection. And so having somebody there at home to help with the chores at home or activities of daily living can be important. I think fitting your tests and your treatment plans in with your other life goals is very important. And I think understanding what those might be, any upcoming trips or upcoming weddings in the family, et cetera, these are things that can be discussed with all of your care providers as you move through the system. And certainly there are some things that need to be done in a more rapid fashion, but there are other things that can wait. And those things that can wait certainly need to be discussed relative to those other life events. I think the other important thing to discuss with all of your care providers is what other services are available. Specifically speaking, social work services within the unit that you're being treated. And another service that many of you may heard of is called an adolescent young adult team. An AYA team is extremely effective, and we certainly utilize ours heavily here at Moffitt Cancer Center for patients up to age 40. An AYA team addresses the specific needs of this patient population, and many times there are patient navigators and other services that can help with the needs of this population that are specific relative to the other patients we see. I think discussing those with any of your care providers along the care continuum is extremely important as a way to meet those goals that you may have. I'd like to just turn the discussion back for questions now, and I look forward to answering what you may have.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mullenix. That was really outstanding and very, very excellent in covering all the different aspects, and particularly your focus on both the surgical aspect of treatment of sarcoma, but also just the quality of life and the importance of managing pain and discomfort. So thank you. And before we take questions, I just want to say a few words actually about the need for sometimes having support, psychosocial support, when you're being treated for or when you have finished your treatment for sarcoma or any type of cancer. So Cancer Care does offer free psychosocial support programs and services. And that, what does that actually mean? Well, we offer financial and practical assistance. We also provide a chance to talk to one of our professionally trained oncology social workers here at Cancer Care. We have quite a few of them, and actually over 40, and actually they're here to provide a number of services, both the chance to talk to someone about your concerns. Also, we have telephone and online support groups, and many people find those groups very effective, both in terms of time saving. A telephone support group means you don't have to travel, and an online group, you don't have to travel either. Online groups are very attractive to different people in different parts of the country or world because they're not time sensitive. So they're free services, and we have a number of groups on sarcoma and different types of cancers as well. I can't say enough about the importance of having a support network. Of course, your healthcare team, as all of our speakers have said, are the place to start, and many of your hospitals and places that you go to have those services in place, but if they don't, it's good to know that you have a place to call, and you can simply call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Now, with that being said, now we have lots of time for questions, and we really want to invite your questions at this point. We have wonderful faculty today, so definitely want your questions. And so I'm going to ask Charlotte if she would tell you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. Charlotte?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Once again.
Okay. And so we do have a question in front of our online participants, and I'm going to ask Dr. I think I'll start with Dr. George, if you could address this question. Are soft tissue sarcoma genetic?
That's a really important question, and I think it's actually a question that I think most people that come in with a new diagnosis of soft tissue sarcoma will pose, because they're very concerned about the impact on their family. So what I can say is that the majority of soft tissue sarcomas are not genetic. We call them sporadic, meaning that they occur for reasons that we don't fully understand. With that said, there's a very small subset of soft tissue sarcomas that do occur in as a result of what we call a cancer predisposition gene. So meaning, yes, there is a very small percentage of soft tissue sarcoma that may be associated with a hereditary risk. The way we tend to think about that in practice is you'll see when you go to see your primary oncologist, or if you come to see a sarcoma specialist, we will do a history. And then based on both the family history of cancer and the personal history of cancer and or the age of diagnosis and perhaps the subtype of the tumor, that may increase the likelihood of our concern for a hereditary cause. And if there is such a concern, then certainly a referral to a cancer geneticist to further understand that risk, if it is indeed present or not, is also very helpful. I would emphasize that I think it's really important that if there are concerns around hereditary cancers, that you know, people will say, well, should I just go, quote unquote, get tested? To me, the first step is to always go see a cancer geneticist. First to talk to your oncologist, if they think appropriate to see a cancer geneticist, to start with counseling, to understand what does it mean or entail, or what are the ramifications of testing for such a condition. And then from there, the testing can occur, which is typically a blood test, and then interpretation of the blood test and implications for the patient and family can ensue.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. And we have another question. I'm going to address this question to Dr. Molinax. This question is, what is meant by the term grade when referring to sarcomas? How is that different from the stage? So if you could address this, Dr. Molinax.
Sure. So this is a great question, and I think something that I always talk with patients about when I first meet them, because a lot of times they come with a diagnosis of a subtype specific sarcoma that, you know, oftentimes the referring provider may say, you know, this isn't something I've seen before. And so I think when we discuss what is meant by sarcoma in general, and specifically the grade, this is something unique to the staging of sarcomas, and thought more about in sarcomas relative to some epithelial derived cancers like breast and colon cancer. So the grade of the tumor is really, in a very simple sense, how different the tumor is from its normal tissue. So when we talk about high grade versus low grade, what we refer to is how active those tumor cells are. They dividing actively, and we think of it as a surrogate for the mutations that led to that malignancy in the first place. A low-grade tumor is typically thought of to be more like the normal tissue that it's derived from, and I think the best example of these, certainly in the diseases that I treat, would be a well-differentiated and a dedifferentiated liposarcoma. So a well-differentiated liposarcoma, both on imaging and if you were to look at the tumor in front of you, looks very much like normal fat, and it's a low-grade tumor. A dedifferentiated liposarcoma on imaging and grossly looking at the tumor in front of you looks very aggressive, cellular, and it's a solid mass. And so I think this is really, you know, when we talk about liposarcoma, that's a great example of high and low grade, but this applies to virtually all subtypes of sarcoma. And so it's something that we use to guide therapy, most specifically the addition of radiation therapy or chemotherapy to surgery alone.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our phone participants, Charlotte.
We have a question coming from the line of Marjorie B. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I am a patient who recently had a dedifferentiated liposarcoma removed from my leg, 21 centimeters by 10 by 7, and seemingly not clear margins in some areas. And so the recommendation is to have more chemo. However, it made me extremely sick, so I'm you know, concerned about what that would look like. But what I haven't been able to find is any reports to look at in terms of recurrence rates. Are there any, like, research papers that are available to the general public that speaks to recurrence rates in situations like mine?
Well, that's an excellent question, Marjorie. Thank you. I think if Dr. Delaney, could you address that question to start with anyway?
Sure. So the tumor is in your thigh?
Yes, I'm sorry.
There are a number of papers that have looked at the rates of local recurrence for soft tissue sarcomas in general. Many, because it's a relatively uncommon disease, there are relatively few papers that are specifically directed at dedifferentiated liposarcoma per se in the thigh, but as a sort of general rule for patients with extremity soft tissue sarcomas, if the tumor is removed with a negative margin, so no tumor at the edge of the specimen. And for a tumor of your size, the surgery would be combined with radiation. The tumor control is in the range of 90% to 95%. If the tumor has been removed with tumor at the edge of the surgical specimen or positive margins, the local control is lower, but still the majority of patients will have the tumor control. The tumor control would be in the range of 75 to 80%, maybe 85%, depending on the radiation dose. In that setting of patients who have positive margins, and Dr. George can comment about this, the literature does suggest that chemotherapy may improve the local control in patients who have positive margins. So again, particularly if there are multiple positive margins, that chemotherapy may enhance the role of radiation. And sometimes if one chemotherapy is not tolerated, alternative agents are available.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. George, do you want to comment further? And also on the main, on the management of the chemotherapy with side effects and things like that, if you could say something as well.
Sure, yes. No, I mean, I completely agree with Dr. Delaney that chemotherapy can be can provide added benefit, in particular, you know, particularly in high-risk tumors in the extremity. The question in part, you know, I think there's probably a lot of subtleties in your case, so I would just be, I just want to sort of add a caution that it's, without really being able to know all the details, it's very hard to, you know, we can't really provide like a case-specific recommendation. What I can say is that the use of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, meaning post-surgically, really varies widely, and the data, as Dr. Delaney said, certainly implies, as tells us that there can be an enhancement of local control. Exactly what the impact is on the distant disease risk, meaning metastatic disease and survival, has varied quite a bit depending on what study one looks at and the patient population included. So that's a decision. The role of chemotherapy after surgery and radiation to me is very much an individualized discussion regarding risks and benefits in an individual case. But certainly we do use it at times, but there are other times that the additional benefit isn't clearly offset by the toxicity risk. And again, those are the subtleties that Dr. Delaney mentioned as well in terms of margins and certain issues of the anatomy. In terms of tolerance of chemotherapy, there's a lot to do to try to help people tolerate chemotherapy better, just, you know, with regard to supportive medication that we can use. For nausea and vomiting, we can modify the dose, we can change the way the drugs are delivered. So there's a lot of different things that one can do to try to optimize the tolerance. And it also depends a little bit on how much chemotherapy you've had before with regard to whether it would make sense to get it again. So again, lots of subtleties that influence sort of a final recommendation.
So we hope this has been helpful and that you can take this back to your treating healthcare team with all of this information. And also, thank you for the excellent question and thank you for all the responses. We have one final question. This will be our last late-breaking question. I'm going to ask if Dr. Mullinex could address this. Can you explain why there is sometimes a differential response of metastases to a treatment? In other words, why does one tumor location respond, but another in a different location does not? And again, this is a general question, and so I'm going to ask Dr. Mullinex to just address this in a general way, and we may have others join in as well, but if you could start the conversation with this, Dr. Mullinex.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. I think this is even a question that's outside of sarcoma and really addresses cancer in general, and we ask this question of ourselves as treating those of us that focus on cancer treatment every day, because you have patients that are either enrolled on a clinical trial or receiving standard of care therapy that may have a fantastic response in one location and not so in another. I think the real answer underlies, you know, what causes cancer in the first place, and the conventional sort of old hypothesis was it was really one aberrant cell that became two and four and divided and divided, and all of those cells were really kind of exactly the same, and from that parent cell that was mutated. And I think we know now that that's actually not the case, and that each tumor and sites within the tumor and different tumors within the same patient are likely different clones and different tumors within that. And so I think the mutations that arise within different metastases and even within different locations of a primary tumor are now recognized to be quite different. And so while one tumor or a group of tumors may respond well to a particular therapy, there certainly are many, many, many cases where the patients have tumors in locations that aren't responding. And that's seen mostly with targeted therapy, but certainly applies to other forms of treatment as well. I think Dr. George probably could elaborate further on that.
Thank you. Dr. George, did you want to say anything further?
No, I mean, I agree completely. I think it's likely just due to various differences in the underlying biology of the tumors. I think the cells get more and more confused and complicated, and sometimes one tumor is being driven by one driver and another tumor could be driven by something somewhat differently. And I think to highlight what Dr. Melnick said, this is an area that's a challenge across all of cancer and really something that I think many investigators in sarcoma and otherwise are trying to help us understand.
So we have a great audience here who asks such really thoughtful and amazing questions that are really being looked at this point. And Dr. Delaney, do you want to add anything as well? So.
No, nothing to add.
Okay. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've been extraordinary, just a wonderful, wonderful team of speakers on this topic of soft tissue sarcoma. I want to thank all of our participants who've been on the call. Some of you have been listening. Of course, many of you have been listening, and some of you have queued up and asked such great questions. And I want to thank you also because your questions allowed our speakers to elaborate on important issues, and your questions demonstrate just how much you as participants really kind of really want to know more and also are very thoughtful about your questions. And we hope you'll take the information, of course, back to your treating healthcare team. I think as Dr. George and many of our other speakers have said, that, of course, your team has all the specific information about you, so you can take that information back to them and see how that applies best to your situation. And as we conclude the call today, we don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of a support world here, of community, of many organizations, Cancer Care being one of them, but there are also a number of sarcoma organizations. And when you get your evaluations, you'll be getting a list of really all of the organizations that we collaborate with on these programs, all of which are terrific resources for you. So you are never really alone in dealing with all the concerns and questions that you may have or a need for help. And so I do encourage all of you to actually, of course, take advantage of these services. And you can, if any of you have medical questions, again, that you have that you want to ask your healthcare team but want to check further about, you can also contact the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And also visit their website at www.cancer.gov. They have a wonderful live chat feature where you can post your question, and one of their information specialists will actually dialogue with you about that. If you, however, have questions regarding just getting some support from Cancer Care Services, you can simply call us at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org where you can post your question as well, and one of our oncology social workers will get back to you. So as we conclude the program today, I hope that this was helpful to all of you, and we look forward to your participation in many of our future programs. Thank you all, and have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.